Ever get that nagging worry about your job security? Or maybe that feeling like, you know, the skills you worked hard for are maybe getting a bit outdated.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel that.
It's something a lot of us are feeling, I think, in this, well, fast world. So today we're doing a deep dive into something really vital for your future. Skills first. What does it mean for me?
Right.
Our mission here is basically to give you a shortcut, a way to understand these huge shifts happening in work, and maybe more importantly, how you can actually navigate them.
And we're basing this on some really interesting work. It's a working paper, the second one in a series, actually, from the Singapore University of Social Sciences Institute for Adult Learning.
U-S-S-I-L-S.
Exactly. And it takes a really thought-provoking look at this skills-first idea, but specifically from your perspective, the individual's perspective. It offers a fresh way to think about career resilience.
Absolutely. So our goal today is, well, first, to unpack why this skills-first thing is becoming so essential. Then, pinpoint those hidden barriers, things that might be holding you back without you even realizing it.
Yeah, the agency gap, they call it.
Exactly. And then explore what this individual-centric career paradigm really looks like in practice. Also, you can feel, hopefully, a bit more empowered, more in control of your own career path.
Sounds good.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We all sort of feel it, don't we? The sense that the ground under our careers is, well, shifting constantly.
Definitely.
The paper dives deep into why that's happening. It argues pretty strongly that traditional career paths just aren't gutting it anymore. What are the big forces you see highlighted that listeners really need to get their heads around?
Well, the paper points to this convergence of global forces. You've got rapid tech change, obviously, AI becoming pervasive.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Then significant demographic shifts, globalization continuing, and even recent things like, you know, the pandemic and geopolitical tensions.
Yeah.
All these things are fundamentally redefining how we learn, how we work, how we even plan our careers. It just demands a much more adaptive approach from everyone.
And it's interesting how those global trends get amplified in specific places, like Singapore, which the paper mentions. You know, with an aging population, people expected to work longer.
Or much longer, yeah. Often across multiple careers, not just one linear path.
So it's not just about finding the next job. It's about navigating this whole landscape that's always kind of moving under your feet.
Precisely. And that really shines a light on the shrinking shelf life of skills.
That's a scary thought.
It is. Some estimates they cite suggest certain technical skills can become obsolete in, like, less than 5 years.
Wow. Less than 5 years.
Yeah. So you can imagine the anxiety that creates for workers, right? Job insecurity, worrying your skills are becoming obsolete, uncertainty about whether putting effort into upskilling will even, you know, pay off.
It's a huge shift from maybe the stability people expected in the past.
A massive shift.
Okay, so the core idea here, the paper suggests, is that this is where the skills-first lens becomes crucial.
Mm-hmm.
It's about focusing on your capacity to manage your productive assets. Is that the term they use?
That's the term. Yeah, your experience, your skills, your proficiency, even your networks.
Right. It's about empowering you to earn, demonstrate, and apply those skills to deliver real value.
That's exactly it. And it reinforces this idea that, look, you can't really just leave career planning entirely up to your employer anymore.
You have to take more ownership.
You absolutely have to take greater ownership. And in this world, skills really are like a currency. They're valuable for your mobility, your economic security, and just your personal agency, your sense of control.
And I liked how the paper also challenges us to think beyond just, you know, the paycheck.
Yes.
Redefining success. Exploring learning as something personal, social, not just about productivity for the company.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Shaped by your values, your interests. It's a much broader view of career development.
Okay, so we've kind of established the why this shift is happening, why skills are the new currency. But if it's so important, why isn't everyone just, you know, jumping on this and taking charge?
Ah, well, that's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, this is the part I find fascinating. The paper identifies these four interconnected forces, barriers, really, that hold people back. They call it the agency gap.
Mm-hmm. That gap between wanting to act and being able to.
Right. Let's try and peel back the layers on these, starting with the external stuff, the situational barriers they talk about. What are those external conditions, like work and life stuff, that get in the way?
Well, one big thing is that often workers just kind of habitually outsource their career development to their employers. It's maybe easier or how it's always been done.
Sure.
But the problem is the company's priorities might not match up with your individual goals or aspirations.
So there's a potential mismatch.
A definite potential mismatch. And common things you hear are, I don't have time, or, crucially, I'm just not sure what skills I should even be learning. That uncertainty is a big one.
Yeah, that feeling of being adrift, not knowing where to even start.
Exactly.
And that uncertainty, that's really what this bigger picture thinking is trying to tackle, isn't it? Empowering you to map out your own path, not wait for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I was really struck by that statistic they mentioned, the Singapore study, showing only, 25% of workers made really thoughtful, deliberate career moves that led to better income and hierarchy.
Yeah, only 25%. It's surprisingly low for something so critical to your future.
It really is.
And it suggests we really need to, spark a wider conversation about how individuals can actually take stock of those productive assets, skills, experience, networks, and build their own learning plans.
And the insight isn't just you should do this, but that there are actually structured ways to approach it.
Yes, exactly. They give examples like Stanford University's Life Design Lab. He uses design thinking principles like you'd use for building a product, but applies them to career and life planning.
Design thinking for your life. Okay.
It breaks it down into manageable steps, makes it less daunting, more experimental. Or right here in Singapore, you have the Public Service Division offering free career coaching and workshops through trained volunteers using an app called WorkPal for public servants. So tools are emerging.
Okay, so that's the external stuff. Now let's talk about what's happening inside us, those internal attitudes, beliefs, maybe even fears that make us hesitate about learning or reskilling.
The psychological barriers, yeah.
And one big one, which feels like a common assumption, is this idea that, as we get older, our brains just sort of decline. Game over for learning new tricks.
Right, like it's inevitable.
Yeah.
But the paper really pushes back on that. Hard. Backed by neuroscience. It stresses that the adult brain can still grow and change. Neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells, actually continues, particularly in areas important for learning and memory.
That's huge. That's myth-busting right there.
It absolutely is. And it makes you ask, okay, if our brains can keep learning, how do we make learning feel more relevant, more connected to who we are in our careers, to our daily work, so we overcome that psychological resistance?
Mm-hmm.
They share some anecdotes like, Wenji, who felt stuck, developed learned helplessness, got demoted, but with a counselor, started reframing those negative beliefs and rebuilding his skills.
So changing the internal story.
Exactly. Or Sharul, who was overlooked for promotion. Coaching helped him see he hadn't kept up with the skills his peers were gaining. He got clarity on what value-adding skills he needed for future roles and started building them.
Both those stories really highlight how important that internal work is, don't they? The paper calls it identity work, reshaping how you see your own value and potential.
Yes, crucial. It's not just about the what's of learning, but your self-concept as a learner. It needs to be tied to your career identity, the relevance to your job. When that connection is strong, engagement goes way up.
So what support exists for this kind of internal shift?
Well, they mentioned things like ERLOL in Europe. That's the European Association of Regional and Local Authorities for Lifelong Learning. They have strategic plans focused on upskilling that explicitly include helping people craft new career identities for mobility.
Interesting.
And projects like Lifelong Guidance 5.0, which aim to boost career counselors' skills, especially with digital tools, so they're better equipped to help people navigate both the skills and the mindset shifts needed for the future. It's about building that internal capacity.
Okay, barrier three. Information, or rather, the lack of clear, easy-to-find, trustworthy information about career options, training pathways, especially when the job market's changing so fast.
Yeah, it feels like trying to navigate a constantly redrawing map, doesn't it?
Totally. You might not even know what the new requirements are. Like, maybe now your job expects you to use AI tools you've never heard of.
Exactly. And this is where the potential of data and technology gets really exciting. Could AI for good, for instance, prompt you to do a career health check? Can we design interventions that are seamless, easy to access?
That's a cool idea, career health checks.
Yeah, and you see steps in that direction. Like Skilled Future Singapore, SSG, they recently launched the Careers and Skills Passport. It's meant to be a central place for all your skills and career data.
Okay.
The hope is that it improves how skills are signaled in the market, both by individuals and employers, pushing towards more skills-first hiring.
But you also hear that even with existing resources like Workforce Singapore, WSG, NTU CZ2I, all those online portals like My Careers Future, my skills future uptake isn't always great.
That's true. There's a lot out there, but maybe it's overwhelming or not visible enough or just hard to navigate. Information overload is real.
So it's not just having the info, it's making it accessible and actionable.
Precisely. Which is why effective skill signaling is so important. You need ways to clearly showcase what you can do, verifiable credentials, project portfolios, and policies need to create clearer pathways.
Any examples of that working well?
Well, the paper mentions Generation, that global nonprofit. They have a very tight 7-step process connecting what employers actually need with who they recruit and how they train them. Very demand-driven.
Right.
Or NTUC's E2I, using an AI-powered virtual career coach for personalized job matches and course suggestions, plus taking services out to neighborhoods with their Heartland job portal, trying to meet people where they are.
Makes sense.
And research, like from the Burning Glass Institute, really underscores that not all credentials are created equal. Some genuinely boost wages and open doors, especially for underserved groups, but many don't deliver.
So you need to know which ones actually work. It's about the right signal, not just any signal.
Exactly. Quality over quantity.
Okay, the final barrier, societal factors, the big picture stuff, broader social norms, contexts that can put certain individuals at a disadvantage when it comes to upskilling or reskilling.
Yeah, this is about the structures and biases around us.
Like gender stereotypes. The paper had that striking stat, a skills-first approach could boost the female talent pool in male-dominated fields by, what, 10%?
10%, yeah. Yeah. Just by focusing on skills, not preconceived notions. Mm. But it also includes discrimination, stigma against certain groups.
Who gets affected most?
Well, think about new folks entering the workforce, people returning after a break, seniors, workers with disabilities, also mid-career or older workers who might be less familiar with the latest tech buzzwords like generative AI or UX design. They can face unique hurdles.
And this brings up an important question, right? What are those social norms or stigmas holding people back? And how can we challenge the way society sometimes undervalues really vital skills?
That's a critical point. One big societal barrier mentioned is how we often undervalue high-skilled trades and craft roles.
Technicians, plumbers, chefs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Essential roles, but sometimes seen as less prestigious than, say, office jobs. The paper suggests one way to tackle this is by actively promoting entrepreneurship among these skilled workers.
Ah, so positioning them as business owners, innovators, not just employees?
Precisely. It could elevate the status of these traits and attract new talent. It challenges that old hierarchy of jobs.
That makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned support for transitions, like for military personnel moving to civilian life. That seems crucial, but maybe not widespread enough.
Definitely not widespread enough. They highlight examples like Singapore's Ministry of Defense having a career transition resource center or the Public Service Division offering coaching to its huge workforce.
But that's within specific sectors.
Exactly. The UK military's career transition program is another great example. They cite comprehensive support, mentors, mapping skills, even guaranteed interviews.
Mm-hmm.
It shows what's possible when you provide tailored, structured support for those tricky transitions, addressing things like skill transferability and cultural fit. It really needs to be more of an ecosystem approach, not just leaving individuals to sink or swim.
Okay, so we've walked through the why and the what's holding us back, lots of challenges there, but the paper doesn't just leave us hanging.
No, it proposes a path forward.
Yeah, this bold shift towards an individual-centric career paradigm. What does that actually look like? How does it change our definition of success?
Well, it fundamentally broadens it. Traditional markers, qualifications, job titles, income, they're still relevant, of course. But success also includes things like enhanced confidence, feeling capable.
Right.
Or the ability to mentor others, share your knowledge, or even just the satisfaction of pursuing your own intellectual curiosity, learning for learning's sake. Singapore has talked about the joy of learning for years.
I remember then DPM Tharman Shanmugaratnam talking about Skills Future back in 2016, framing it as empowering lifelong self-renewal.
Exactly. And what's really fascinating connecting to that is a finding they mention. Singapore scores really well globally on learning to know the knowledge part, and learning to do the practical skills.
Okay, makes sense.
But compared to other OECD countries, it scores lower on learning to be personal developments, values, identity, and learning to live with others, collaboration, social skills.
Huh. So there's room to grow in the more holistic aspects.
That's what it suggests. A need to focus more on personal growth, well-being, alongside economic productivity. And this leads to the concept of career self-management.
Define that for us.
It's seeing your career not as a series of jobs, but as a lifelong self-directed process. You're constantly planning, adapting your goals, your learning activities, always considering your career VIPS.
VIPS.
Yeah, it's an acronym for values, interests, personality, and skills or competencies. Basically, knowing yourself and using that knowledge to guide your career choices.
I like that. And this idea of whole-of-life career self-management sounds really powerful, too. Intentionally building resources, including mental health support.
Yes. It explicitly connects career well-being with overall well-being, which fits perfectly with Singapore's national focus on mental health. Your work life isn't separate from the rest of your life.
So true.
And this approach helps explain those mobility archetypes they discuss, like the stable achievers versus the explorers. What really separates them is often their level of agency and these career self-management skills.
So the achievers are better at managing their VIPS, essentially.
They tend to be, yes. Which also highlights why career advisory support is so critical, especially for people who feel overwhelmed or have low decision-making readiness, as the paper puts it. They need help navigating the choices.
Okay, but this raises a really important point about equity, doesn't it? If we shift to this individual-centric model, how do we make sure it actually reaches everyone, especially people facing systemic barriers?
Absolutely crucial question.
You know, people from lower income backgrounds, caregivers who are time poor, those with lower education levels who might lack resources or digital skills, how do they participate fully?
And that's where this quite radical insight of compassionate meritocracy comes in. It's a challenge to the traditional view.
Compassionate meritocracy. Tell me more.
It means looking at merit not just based on performance outcomes, but considering the starting point, looking at access, support, structural disadvantages. Are we unintentionally penalizing someone because they have caregiving duties or limited access to tech, even if they have huge potential?
So acknowledging the playing field isn't level.
Exactly. And therefore, the need for tailored, targeted support to help every worker succeed, not just those who already have advantages. It's about equity built into the system.
Okay, so wrapping this all up, the core message seems to be the skills-first approach is fundamentally about you taking ownership.
Mm-hmm. Ownership to review, refresh those productive assets, your skills, experience, networks, and really embrace continuous learning as just part of life now.
It's about building your own skills-first readiness through that self-directed, whole-of-life career self-management we talked about.
Right. But, crucially, knowing that support should be there when you need it, like career guidance or coaching.
And you mentioned support systems being key, like Singapore's tripartism, government, unions, employers working together. That sounds important.
Hugely important. It enables things like significant investment in company training, grants, and those enhanced government programs. WSG's Career Conversion Program, the Skills Future Career Transition Program, specifically designed to help people make career shifts.
And it's not just about training courses, is it? It's also about exploring options, maybe shifting your mindset, getting that guidance through coaching or counseling.
Yes, which makes it great that people can now use their Skills Future credits, those government learning credits, for career coaching and mentorship.
That seems like a really practical step.
It is, alongside newer initiatives like Career Health SG, launched in 2024, which is all about helping individuals plan longer-term career paths.
So the bottom line is, as careers get less predictable, more nonlinear, thinking in terms of skills as your currency really empowers you. It lets you make more informed strategic moves, build resilience, and stay relevant.
Absolutely. It's about navigating change, not just reacting to it. Building resilience and relevance in this, well, fast-changing world of work.
So here's a final thought for you listening. If skills truly are the new currency, how are you going to intentionally invest in your skills portfolio this year? Not just to survive, but to really thrive and maybe even reinvent yourself in this evolving world of work. Something to think about.